Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired.
Hello and welcome. In honor of Mother's Day, during this May segment of Flavor, we will honor all women. And while honoring all women, I'll invite you to consider a broader question. What does it truly mean to have autonomy? While women are often told they can choose their paths, whether in motherhood, career, or personal life, those choices are often shaped by systems out of their control. Systems that influence access, opportunity, and even health. In this segment, we'll explore how these systems were built and how they have evolved. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Chapter 8 from Social Justice and Advocacy and Human Services, titled Being a Woman in the United States, which explores the history of women's rights, social movements, and ongoing challenges that shape women's lives today. I would like to remind you that sections of this chapter will be abbreviated due to the time constraints of this segment. Thus, I am Nicole McMahon with the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Flavor. Let's begin. Social Justice and Advocacy in Human Services, Copyright 2025, Chapter 8, Being a Woman in the United States, written by Nikki Golden and Bernadette DeJong. The Women's Rights Movement, the First Wave, 1848 through 1920s. Seneca Falls. In the late 1800s, most women understood they did not have the same privileges and rights as men. Many women have been active in other social justice movements such as abolition and learned to organize, raise money, and engage in public speaking. As a result, some women individually rallied against these inequities. It took Mott and Staton 8 years, but on July 19, 1848, the first Women's Rights Convention was held in Seneca Falls, New York. Mott and Staton led the convention to launch the women's rights movement in the United States. During its course, Staton wrote and read the Declaration of Sentiments. This declaration was intentionally based on the Declaration of Independence. It was intended to dramatize the denied citizenship claims of elite women during the period when the early republic's founding documents privileged white property males. Social justice movements. While women participated in the suffrage movement, they also participated in many other social justice movements, including the social morality movement, the anti-slavery movement, as well as the labor reform movement. The social morality movement. Starting in the late 19th century, white middle and upper class women in the United States began to be lauded as the moral soul of the new nation. During that time, women believed it was their responsibility to teach men to be good and moral. This culture shift gave women a new sense of empowerment. The two most prevalent issues women took a stand on during this time was prostitution and drunkenness. Prior to the 1800s, many in the United States viewed prostitution as a necessary evil. Women in particular had a genuine reason to despise prostitution because it made a mockery of the widely cherished notions of women's innate modesty and purity. In 1848, New York passed the first state's seduction law in the United States. The seduction laws punished men for taking advantage of young women by promising, among other things, marriage to obtain sex. Other states followed this precedent, and by 1885, 27 states had seduction laws. Seductions made punishable up to 5 years in prison in New York State and up to 20 years in other states. Often, women of color, prostitutes, and women of over the age of 37 were excluded from the protection of the seduction laws. The anti-slavery movement. By the early 1800s, societal views on slavery were shifting as most men and women recognized the incompatibility between America's founding principles of equality and at least some of its inherited structures. By the mid-1830s, women anti-slavery societies were established across the northeastern areas of the United States.
Black women participated in the anti-slavery movement, and former slaves such as Harriet Jacobs, as well as Sojourner Truth, shared their lived experiences. Other black women, such as Nancy Raymond, founded formal anti-slavery organizations. Many of the women in the anti-slavery movement, such as Lucretia Mott and Stephanie B. and Susan B. Anthony, as well as Angelina Grimke, were Quakers. Traditionally, Quakers had been anti-slavery throughout the establishment of the American colonies and were later active in the Underground Railroad movement. Despite the belief that Stanton and Anthony had had that others shared their vision for universal suffrage, there continued to be dissension in the anti-slavery movement. Wendell Phillips, the president of the American Anti-Slavery Society, believed that interests of women and black men needed to be divided to achieve political gains. Even Frederick Douglass, a longtime supporter of the women's rights and Anthony's friend, believed women should step aside so that black men could attain their rights. During a debate at the AERA meeting, Douglass stated that women, because they are women, are hunted down through the cities of New York and New Orleans, and when they are dragged from their houses and hung upon lampposts, and when they're in danger of having their homes burned down over their heads, then they will have the urgency to obtain the ballot equal to her own. Many women, such as Anthony and Stanton, had worked tirelessly in the anti-slavery movement. They were devastated by the growing dissent and perceived statements such as these as betrayal. Stanton believed that elevating one's oppressed group over another tempted it to be abused, attempted it to abuse others lower on the ladder. Sojourner Truth stated that there is a great stir about colored men getting their rights, but not one word about colored women. If colored men get their rights and colored women not theirs, the colored men will be masters over women, and it will be just as bad as it was before. The 14th and 15th Amendments. In 1868, Congress passed the 14th Amendment. Its ratification meant that, for the first time, the word male was in the United States Constitution. The 14th Amendment granted birthright citizenship to all men in the United States, all men born in the United States, In 1870, the 15th Amendment was ratified, giving all citizens the right to vote. Because the 14th Amendment declared all men as citizens, the 15th Amendment then gave all men the right to vote. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on the account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Anthony and Stanton objected to the 14th and 15th Amendments, not because they gave voting rights to all men, but because they did not do so the same for all women. Labor reform movement. By the 19th century, it was not uncommon for women of lower economic status to contribute to their family survival by working for wages. With the opening of textile mills, young women moved out of their family homes and worked in the mills. Working conditions in these textile mills were challenging, and the young women complained that they were penalized by having their wages reduced or losing their jobs. In 1834, a young group of women known as the Lowell Girls went on strike to protest a proposed wage reduction. Unfortunately, the strike failed as the young women needed more leverage to win. However, the strike resulted in the establishment of the first working women's union in the United States, the Factory Girls Association. During the early 1900s, nearly one in five manufacturing jobs in the United States were held by women, and many fought for labor protections and rights for women. The National Congress of Mothers, later known as the Parent Teacher Association, was one of the organizations that advocated for labor protection for women. Women such as Jane Addams and Florence Kelly led the fight for women's labor reform, including minimum wage laws, maximum hours work laws, as well as child labor laws. In 1906, Kelly hired attorneys Louis Brandeis as well as Josephine Goldmark to argue for protecting women laborers in landmark case Mueller v. Oregon. Mueller, who owned a laundry business, was convicted of violation of the Oregon labor laws because he had made his female workers work over 10 hours a day. Mueller challenged the conviction and took his case to the Oregon State Supreme Court. The Mueller v. Oregon case was, according to Kelly, representative of the need for protection for women laborers across the United States. Part of their argument was based on the premise that working long hours is more disastrous to the health of women than of men and entails upon them more lasting injuries. Brandeis and Goldmark were victorious in the Mueller v. Oregon. The case provided the protections that Kelly wanted for women laborers. Mueller v. Oregon had positive and negative long-lasting effects that could not have been predicted. The most detrimental effect was that it opened the door for decades of gender discrimination in the workplace. Lepore states that these laws rested on the idea that women were dependent not only on men, but on the state. If women ever were to achieve equal rights, this sizable body of legislation designed to protect women would stand in their way. One of Mueller v. Oregon's positive effects was that it created a legal precedent for the use of social science in court cases. Between 1909 and 1917, a maximum work hours laws was maximum work hour labor laws for women existed in 39 states. By 1923, minimum wage laws for women existed in 15 states. And by 1920, laws that provided financial relief for women through mothers' and widows' pensions had been passed in 40 states. Florence Kelly and others worked incredibly hard to get labor laws passed for women. This was a great accomplishment in protecting women who could not protect themselves. The 19th Amendment. At the turn of the 20th century, women still could not vote in the United States. As the founders of the women's rights movement aged and passed away, it felt like the suffrage movement had stalled. In time, new radical women activists stepped up to carry on the cause. Women like Mary Church Terrell and Carrie Chapman Catt infused new life and ideas in the women's suffrage movement. As Jim Crow laws continued to oppress black people in the United States, tension increased between black and white women in the suffrage movement. Some white women championed white supremacy by actively endorsing suffrage for white women only. Rebecca Felton, a former slaveholder and the wife of a liberal congressman from Georgia, advocated for both women's suffrage and the lynching of every black fiend who lays unholy and lustful hands on a white woman. Many Southern suffragists organized against women like Felton, but had little success in impacting the racist rhetoric. Many white women in the suffrage movement felt they needed to make difficult decisions to obtain the right to vote. They understood that if women won the suffrage battle in the United States, more black women would not be allowed to exercise their vote, as the majority of black women still lived in Southern states with oppressive Jim Crow laws. If the suffrage movement were successful and obtained the right to vote for all women, that would inscribe non-racist, non-sexist laws in the Constitution that nominally doubled the number of black voters. Most women's suffrage organizations took the middle path and continued to fight for all women, but did not confront the concerns about Jim Crow laws. In 1914, for the first time since 1887, the United States Congress agreed to allow women's suffrage bill, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, to be brought to the floor for a vote. After Congress engaged in a three-hour debate, it was clear that racism was the biggest obstacle to women obtaining the right to vote. Extremists like Senator James Vollmer went as far as to propose trading black male suffrage for women's suffrage. As the United States entered the World War I, American women were needed to fill jobs left by soldiers going overseas. Women such as Carrie Chapman Catt took advantage of this need. When asked by President Wilson to assist with promoting the war effort, Catt agreed to support Wilson's war efforts in exchange for his support of women's suffrage. In 1918, Wilson honored his agreement with Catt and supported the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. It was unclear if Wilson believed in the women's rights or if he was concerned about the image of the United States. By 1918, 24 countries, including Germany, had already granted women the right to vote, and the United States was lagging behind the rest of the world. The United States Senate voted against the women's suffrage four times, in 1887, 1914, 1918, and again in February 1919. However, on June 4, 1919, the Senate passed the Susan B. Anthony Amendment. Ironically, the segregationist senator helped the amendment pass by two votes. On August 18, 1920, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, known as the 19th Amendment, was ratified. It simply read, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." The addition of the sentence to the Constitution took decades to achieve. Not all states ratified the 19th Amendment. Mississippi, the last state to ratify, did not do so until 1984. The ratification of 19th Amendment was a milestone. However, it also had significant limitations. In the United States, racism still trumped the law. Black women were subjected to blatantly discriminatory practices, including unfairly administered literacy tests, and the grandfather clauses that prevented descendants of enslaved people from voting while allowing illiterate whites to vote if their grandparents had. Other tactics employed by states included white-only primaries and accusations of missed registration deadlines. In addition to Black Americans being discriminated against in their right to vote, the 19th Amendment also failed to protect indigenous women, women who lived in the United States territories or the District of Columbia. The 19th Amendment did not apply to indigenous women because they were not citizens of the United States. However, not all indigenous people desire United States citizenship. Although Zikalasa advocated for indigenous citizenship, she did not believe it would resolve the systemic racism that indigenous people face in the United States. Ultimately, Zikalasa believed citizenship was a necessary remedy for a broader illness. Post-19th Century Amendment. Alice Paul introduced the Equal Rights Amendment at the National Women's Party Convention in 1921. The ERA, as written by Paul, declared, "No political, civil, or legal disabilities or inequalities on the account of sex or on account of marriage, unless applying equally to both sexes, shall exist within the United States or any territory subject to its jurisdiction thereof." In 1963, the Civil Rights Act was presented to the House Rules Committee. Title VII of the Civil Rights Act banned discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, and national origin. Paul asked Smith to add sex to Title VII, and Smith agreed. With Smith's endorsement, sex was successfully added to Title VII and signed into law on July 2, 1964. The ERA passed by the House of Representatives in 1971 and the Senate in 1972. However, for the ERA to be enacted into law, it needed to be ratified by 38 states. Members of Congress who opposed the ERA had set an arbitrary time limit of 7 years for ratification. By 1973, 30 states had ratified the ERA. During this time, the ERA gained a new opponent, Phyllis Schlafly, and her Stop campaign, which meant Stop Taking Our Privileges, campaign rallied heavily against the ERA. Schlafly viewed the ERA as a bottomless pit of horrors. She feared the ERA would make women subject to the military draft, damage labor protections for women, force happy homemakers to work, and negate women's rights to alimony and child support. Schlafly used her fears to motivate the army of the radical right women followers. By 1977, the ERA was stalled, with only 35 of the necessary 38 states having ratified it. By 1982, the ERA's time limit extension had expired, and the ERA was never ratified. Now we move on to the women's rights movement, the second wave, from 1960s to current. During this period, you will see that the focus and therefore the law shift to regulate women's bodies. That leads us to reproductive justice movement. The history of Black women in the United States is fraught with reproductive injustice. During the many atrocities of the American slave trade, enslaved women's bodies were not ever their own. Their gender was unacknowledged most of the time. However, at the same time, the slave owners were invested in enslaved women's reproductive function as a financial investment. Enslaved women's economic value increased with each completed pregnancy, and slave owners often forced mating between slaves. However, pregnancy was not considered a reason to excuse enslaved women from work or punishment. If a pregnant woman did something to anger the overseer, he might dig a hole in the ground big enough to contain her stomach, force her to lie down, and then beat her, in that way protecting the unborn child, which was the master's property. Childbirth. Before the 1870s, midwives and other female healers assisted women through birth, contraception, and even abortion. By the 1870s, however, the practice of medicine was established as a male profession, and medical doctors lobbied for regulated qualifications, which disqualified midwives from practicing medicine. In addition, at the same time, women were not accepted into medical schools in the United States. Thus, for the first time in history, reproductive concerns in the United States were no longer in control of by women, but instead by the control of the men. In the early 1900s, many medical professionals refused to use anesthesia during childbirth despite it having been available since 1831. Aside from beliefs that anesthetics were dangerous, time-wasting, and likely to drive women erotically insane, most physicians still felt that they should be the judges of pain of childbirth. As part of the quest for reproductive justice, women challenged the idea that pain was a necessary and inevitable part of childbirth. Birth control. By 1921, Sanger founded the American Birth Control League, eventually known as Planned Parenthood, and continued to support women's access to birth control and education about their bodies. In the early 1950s, Sanger both personally and through Planned Parenthood provided partial funding to research an oral contraceptive for women. The first clinical trials for oral contraceptives were held in Puerto Rico. The trial utilized racial bias, unethical, and unsafe methods. Although Puerto Rican women, due to poverty, had a genuine need for birth control methods, they were not informed that they were being used as test subjects, nor were they informed of the potential side effects of the drug. On June 23, 1960, the United States Food and Drug Administration approved the release of Inovit, commonly referred to as the pill. Inovit was the first oral hormonal birth control for women. Historical fears that women's sexual freedom would lead to the destruction of moral and societal values pervaded medical, religious, and governmental attitudes towards the pill from its very inception. By its release date, it was illegal for doctors to prescribe Inovit in 30 states. In 1965, the United States Supreme Court ruled in Griswold v. Connecticut that married women had constitutional right to privacy, which included the decision to use birth control. It was not until 1972 when the United States Supreme Court ruled in Baird v. Eisenstadt that unmarried women, due to their constitutional right to privacy, could legally use birth control. So, due to time constraints, I will briefly discuss forced sterilization as well as the anti-rape movement. According to the 2022 report from the National Women's Law Center, 31 states and the District of Columbia currently have laws on books that allow for forced sterilization of disabled women. Only 2 states specifically ban forced sterilization, and the other 17 states have either statutes with loopholes or have a court rulings that have suggested forced sterilization may be possible. In 1994, the United States Congress passed the Violence Against Women Act, which was the first federal law that acknowledged domestic violence and sexual violence against women as crime. However, the Violence Against Women Act was not permanent as it requires reauthorization, generally every 5 years. Reauthorization was passed in 2000, 2005, 2013, and again in 2022. That brings us to abortion. Abortion has existed in the United States regardless of legality. Before the 1800s, common law allowed free women to have abortions up until fetal movement, known as the quickening, was detected. Thus, it was the pregnant woman who decided when and if they chose to abort, as only they could feel the fetal movements. Abortions were induced using herbs and some medications usually given by midwives. White male gynecologists viewed skilled black and indigenous midwives as an affront to their professional image, and by the early 1800s, states had passed laws that limited or prohibited abortion. In 1845, the state of Massachusetts was the first to pass a law to prohibit abortion for any reason. By 1857, the American Association of Medicine coordinated a national drive to outlaw abortion and midwifery, both to ensure women's safety and to eliminate competition for obstetrical patients. The AMA succeeded in both goals. By 1900, all 45 states had laws that made abortion illegal. Any exception to the law was decided by doctors. Many doctors provided abortions for women who had the necessary medical connections and the money to pay for the procedure. For women who had neither, often marginalized women, abortion was either not available or unsafe. By 1970, approximately 20 constitutional cases were challenging restrictive abortion laws. In 1971, two abortion cases, Doe v. Bolton, as well as Roe v. Wade, were brought to the United States Supreme Court. Doe v. Bolton challenged a Georgia state law that allowed abortions in cases of rape, fetal deformity, or potential severe harm to a woman. Roe v. Wade challenged an 1857 Texas law that banned abortion unless determined to be life-saving for a woman. In 1973, the United States Supreme Court ruled on Doe v. Bolton as well as Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade was a critical case because it challenged the right of states to ban abortions altogether. And the court's ruling Roe v. Wade signified that women had control over their decisions about their bodies. Specifically, the outcome of Roe v. Wade upheld the idea of liberty derived from the 14th Amendment. The Roe v. Wade backlash. However, the court's ruling included a loophole for states' compelling interests, which could justify restrictive state regulations. On June 24 of 2022, the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with a ruling on Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. The court's ruling on Dobbs erased the federal protection for women and gave decisions about abortions back to the individual states. The court ruled that the right to privacy is controversial because such a right is not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. Many American women believed that bodily autonomy was their guaranteed right in the United States after Roe v. Wade decision. However, the Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision, American women have learned that bodily autonomy was never their guaranteed right in the United States. It was only a law. In conclusion, as we reflect on this reading, we are reminded that being a woman in the United States has never been defined by a single moment in history. It has been shaped by systems that use laws to govern the rights and therefore the behaviors of women. With this segment of Flavor, my hope has been to honor women by acknowledging this history of the victories as well as the ongoing struggles they face. I am Nicole McMahon, and this has been Flavor. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is now available as a podcast on our website at NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening, and so long until the next time.